This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Today we're talking about a new podcast from the BBC and Frontline PBS called I'm Not a Monster, which attempts to uncover the truth behind an Elkhart woman and her family moving to ISIS-controlled Syria in 2015. We're joined now by the writer of the I Am Not a Monster podcast, who's been investigating this story for about 4 years, and who joins us live from London. Josh Baker, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here with you.
Yeah, it's excellent to talk to you from across the pond. Such an interesting story. I've been, of course, remember when this happened and when we heard first from her and her son, and so much to unpack here. When did you first find out about Sam Sally, right, and her family?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of came to it in quite an unusual way, if you like. So back in November 2016, I was in an Iraqi city called Mosul. This city had been taken by ISIS, and I was with Iraqi special forces who were pushing into the city and trying to retake it from ISIS. Now, while I was there, unfortunately, I was hit by an ISIS suicide bomb, which injured me quite badly. But I was very lucky, unlike the people on the street that this bomb detonated on, I was able to leave and get back to the UK and start recovering. Now, while I was there, a contact of mine who I completely lost touch with heard I'd been injured. So got in contact with him and was like, you know, how are you? How are you doing? We have to meet. So I went to meet him for a coffee and we're talking and he just starts to mention offhand that there's an American family trapped in Raqqa in Syria. Now, Raqqa, Syria at the time was the heart of the ISIS caliphate. It was, you know, their de facto capital. It was the center of ISIS's terrorism. And he was telling me there was this American family from South Bend, Indiana, trapped there. And I was sort of like, hold on, roll it back. What do you mean there's an American family trapped there? And then he proceeded to take his phone out of his pocket and he hit play on a video. And the video that he showed me was of Sam's son, a boy called Matthew. And he was being forced to assemble a suicide bomb. Now, obviously, I just lived through a suicide bombing and now I'm confronted with a young boy being forced to make his own bomb. So it sort of gave me this immense drive to try and find out where the boy was, what was going on, and find out how he got there.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it's not your average start to a story, is it?
No, certainly not. How are you today? I mean, I understand that your injuries are quite extensive, and just going through something like that, you know, as a journalist, who were you working for at the time? Wow.
I mean, I was there with Frontline and I was also working for the Guardian at the same time. And it was very tough. I mean, I am lucky that I'm fully recovered. The only sort of lasting injuries I have is as weird as it sounds. I have these tiny bits of shrapnel, which is brick, under my scalp. And it's sort of minuscule amounts. But every now and again, it sort of pushes its way to the surface and just comes out, which I know sounds immensely weird. You would never know, but there's so much in there. I'm told it will be there for the rest of my life. Actually, the trauma doctor when I was in hospital said, look, it's nothing to worry about. Your grandparents were full of shrapnel. And I said to him, are you a descendant of Rambo or something? You know, my grandparents aren't full of shrapnel, but it's just something I have to live with. I'm very lucky.
Unbelievable. So back to the family. I mean, obviously, you know, it's amazing that you found that, you know, that connection and that drive to really understand what's going on in this particular story. Because as we know, as journalists, I mean, that's what drives us, the stories. What was there known about this family right now and their situation? What could you find out initially?
So initially, it was very, very minimal. It was just that they were in Raqqa, supposedly. They were trapped there and they were looking for a way out. And I said, well, how do you know they're looking for a way out? And then my contact said to me, well, you know, Sam has a sister in Indiana. And I was like, oh, what's her name? And her name is Laurie. So I managed to get in contact with Laurie. And then I got on a plane to meet her. And when I met Laurie, she had just received, she read to me an email that she had just received from her sister, which I think you've got a clip of, if I'm right.
Yes, I believe we do.
Do you want to play that now? I
think so right now. Thanks.
I have to be forward with you because I don't have a lot of time. Almost every day, 5 to 10 bombs are dropped around us. The shockwaves are insane. It rains shrapnel, everything from rocks to metal sheets to glass shards. I have no idea where I will end up if you don't help me. So please help me now. We are talking a matter of days, not weeks.
So that's Sam's sister, Lori, reading an email from her, correct?
Yeah, that's Sam's sister, Lori, reading an email from her sister, Sam. And this was the sort of first time that Lori had heard that her sister wasn't even in America, let alone that she was with a terror group like ISIS and that she was there with her family. So what followed over the next sort of almost year, 8 months to a year, was Lori and I trying to work out, first of all, is this true? And it was. Sam was in Raqqa with her family. And then trying to track them and work out what was happening. And if they were, you know, alive at points, it became very hard to know if they were still alive, because American-backed forces on the ground in Syria by sort of the middle of 2017 were carrying out a highly effective campaign against ISIS, and they were defeating ISIS, and they pushed ISIS largely back to Raqqa, the city where Sam was trapped, and they had just entered the city in June. And it was at this point Lori lost contact with her sister. She'd had some sporadic messages before, and she had no idea if they were alive. So up until that point, I've been trying to piece together, you know, where were they? Are they in this part of the city? How can we find out if they're still alive? And then they vanished. And then I think about 6 weeks went by and a video was released by ISIS. Now, it was in the sort of the dying days of the battle for Raqqa. ISIS were almost defeated. American-backed forces were very much winning. And ISIS chose to use Matthew, Sam's son, as a propaganda tool. And they forced him to issue a message. It was very obvious from the video that he was reading a script. But they forced him to threaten President Trump. And this was beamed around the world. So we suddenly discovered that the family were alive, or were recently. And this story that I had been working on for so long became this sort of global thing of who are this family? Where are this family?
Wow. And what year was that then when we got
that? That was August 2017.
2017. So, you know, and you said, you know, you felt this need to do the story. What was your goal in doing the story? Did you know what you wanted to find out?
Yeah, I mean, in the first instance, as idealistic as it sounds, I wanted to find the family. I wanted to find this boy and find out how he was in this situation. And I knew that might not be achievable. So I wanted to also find out how they got there. And what's funny is that video comes out, it's beamed around the world. We sort of lose contact again. We have no contact, no idea where they are. Now I'm in England. My dad, I come from a long line of hairdressers, a hair salon, and I was helping him renovate his business. And I'm sort of standing on a ladder. I've just cut a hole in the ceiling and I'm taking a break. And I've got a cup of tea in one hand and my phone in the other. And I'm scrolling Twitter. And this has become a daily routine for me at this point. I'm looking for any sign that the family might still be alive. You know, I'm checking ISIS sites. I'm checking Twitter. I'm checking Facebook. Just anything. Is there any semblance of them? And by complete luck, I come across a video of Sam, her children, and some other people escaping Raqqa. And it's just been filmed. Wow. And somebody's put it on social media. And I'm, you know, you can imagine I'm on this ladder. I'm like, oh, my God, that's them. So within a few weeks of seeing that video, I got on the road and eventually made it into Syria. Wow. And I began a 10-day search to find Sam.
Unbelievable. Were you hesitant to return to Syria?
No, it was my first time in Syria. When I was blown up initially, it was in Iraq.
Oh.
But No, because by the time I was doing this, I'd taken some time to look after myself mentally and physically. I was fit. And, you know, as I said to you, it was this overpowering desire to find Matthew. So I remember the journey there was really difficult because there was some internal fighting going on in Iraq. So airports were closed. So it took us about 36 hours just to get to the border of Syria. And when we got there, you know, Syria is still to this day in a state of war. Yes. So it's not like you can just fly into Syria and leave the airport. We had to go to Iraq. We had to travel across northern Iraq to the border of Syria. Then we had to get in a homemade boat and cross this sort of makeshift crossing into the country and get out the other side. And then we worked with local journalists to sort of then from there start to explore northeastern Syria and try and work out where Sam and the kids were, which was obviously very bizarre because we were largely in the territory of an American-backed militia. And at that time, they weren't really used to Westerners just turning up to their bases. But we would go there, we would turn up, we'd show pictures of Sam and the kids. And eventually, we found Sam. And I then got this multi-hour interview with Sam, which was her account of everything that happened. Now, Sam says that she was tricked into going to ISIS, that she was deceived by her husband and she didn't want to be there. But there is also evidence to suggest the opposite to that.
Right.
So the podcast series over 10 episodes, I'm Not a Monster, is basically about trying to work out whether Sam chose to do this or whether she was tricked, and then work out why this happened.
As I can imagine, it's complicated, and truth might not be exactly what it seems. We will talk more about Sam and her story with Josh when we come back after this break. We're talking about a new podcast from the BBC and the Frontline PBS called I'm Not a Monster, which tells the story of an Indiana woman and her family moving to ISIS, controlled Syria back in 2015. We will be back with Josh Baker. I'm Jill Sheridan. In 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. We're talking today about a new podcast from the BBC and Frontline PBS called I'm Not a Monster, which tells the story of an Indiana woman and her family moving to ISIS-controlled Syria in 2015. We're joined by Josh Baker, who wrote the I'm Not a Monster podcast and has been investigating this story for 3 years now. You know, I've seen a little bit of the documentary film that aired, and on top of the podcast, I'd like to talk about your process for a while. You know, what was it about a podcast that seemed appealing to tell this story as an audio journalist?
Well, you know, I love documentary filmmaking, and I've been lucky enough to do that for a little while now. But we're always constrained in documentary film by a time limit. So either we've got, you know, 45 minutes, 52 minutes, an hour. There's a set amount of time to which we can put this story on screen, which inevitably means you have to leave things out, and sometimes a lot of things out. Now, if you can imagine, over 3 or 4 years, we have a lot of material, and there's a lot of things we've been able to find out about Sam and her family. So for me, this always was going to be a story that was going to be better told in audio as part of a podcast series.
Do you enjoy it?
Oh, God, I love it, because it's something, you know, there's an intimacy to it that perhaps we don't always get to experience in filmmaking. And, you know, I get people contacting me every day about the series, and it's quite nice chatting to them and working out what they like about it and what they're taking from it. So it allows us to go into all these details we would never normally talk about, you know. So, for example, one thing that's, there's many things in the podcast that aren't in the film, but after Laurie initially gets this email from Sam, she finds herself in this mad situation where she's communicating with a supposed people smuggler who's in Syria, who's offering to get Sam and her family out for a price. And Laurie starts in a back and forth negotiation with this people smuggler. The FBI get involved. And we don't talk about any of that in the film, but in the podcast series, it's a massive part of episode two.
Wow. How did, so she's working with the FBI on this. Did you interact with the FBI at all? What was that like, having them involved while you were investigating?
Inevitably, the FBI can't really comment, unfortunately, when they're doing an ongoing investigation. But it wasn't for lack of trying on my part to speak to them. They were all very cordial, but unfortunately wouldn't go there. I did at a later date get to speak to some very senior people at the Department of Justice who were able to give some really interesting insight into why they feel things happened and what motivated Sam to make certain decisions along the way.
This is something you've obviously been working on for so long. How do you know when a multi-year project like this is done?
Very good question. This project was done many times over the last few years. There were many points where we were sort of calling it, okay, fine, it's going out, this is going to happen. But things just got in the way. Either Sam's trial, when she was brought back to the US, she was accused of a number of things. Either Sam's trial date kept getting pushed, so we couldn't do it until the trial was completed. And then, there were things like that. Then there was coronavirus, so that delayed things. All that said, though, it really meant that the project, or the sort of storytelling, the gathering of new information part, ended at kind of a very special time, with Sam having gone through her trial, her son Matthew back with his father, and the other kids back with the grandparents. So it allowed us to round off this story in a way that we would never have been able to do otherwise.
Stars aligned.
Exactly.
So you've worked on a lot of stories about ISIS. What was unique about this story?
I can honestly say, hand on heart, I've never come across a story like this, period. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have somehow got a woman from South Bend, a woman who was living in South Bend, Indiana, who ended up at the heart of the ISIS caliphate, seemingly did not believe in ISIS's ideology at all. So she's not, does not appear to be a religious extremist in any way, shape or form. And then came back and came home. And, I don't want to spoil it too much, but, before Sam even left America, she was even an FBI informant. So there is so many hidden things to her story, and her situation is so unique that it kind of requires a 10-part podcast series to really get into the depths of what happened.
The psychology behind.
Totally.
So back to the video that you saw when you first met with Sam's sister, Lori, and you saw Matthew. But by the way, how many other children does she have?
So there are four children in total.
Okay.
Matthew's the oldest.
And the one, obviously, that was in the ISIS propaganda videos.
Yeah.
What are you thinking when you're the one of the first people here in the States, or you were in the States at the time, to see that? What were you thinking when you first saw that video of Matthew?
I mean, I was pretty horrified, to be honest with you, because I think he was about 9 years old, thereabouts, at the time when he was being made to do this. And you sort of see him sitting in a living room. And the more that you stare at this video, the more details start to leap out at you. So you notice that there are weapons behind him. There's a rifle and a shotgun. And then you notice his feet, the components of a bomb. And, the world came to know ISIS's very sort of slickly produced propaganda that we would all see on TV, and very horrific things were depicted through that. But this was something different. This had the feel of a home video. This felt like it was something filmed in somebody's house. And I would take that video to various experts, and all of them would say, we've never seen anything like this. This is so rare to see a video like this come from inside ISIS's self-declared caliphate. And my feelings were, my God, this poor boy, how has he ended up in this situation? And I think one of the things that was particularly difficult for Matthew is that, he had no choice in making that video. He was forced to do it, sometimes violently. And when he was forced to appear in the ISIS propaganda video, again, this was something where if he refused, it could have cost him his life. So when that went out into the world, the difficulty down the line was, are people just going to view this boy as a threat or as, you know, somebody associated to ISIS, which he's very much not.
I remember when it popped up in the news cycle and just how different it was from the things, like, as you mentioned, that we had seen in the past, the beheadings and the other propaganda videos that we were so familiar with. And, you know, talking with Sam's sister, Lori, she told you, I guess, that she had to build a metaphorical bubble around herself when she had phone calls about what was happening as she was, you know, getting information. What does she mean by that?
Well, if you can imagine, I mean, imagine any of your listeners or you yourself, you know, you have your everyday life, you're used to your routine. And then suddenly you find yourself in a situation where you've got to continue everyday life. You know, you've got to look after your kids, you've got to go to work. But at the same time, you have to be on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to your sister who's trapped in the middle of a war zone with her kids, is looking for a way out. And then on top of that, there's a man saying he's a people smuggler who's going to help get them out that will call you at the most random times. So she just found herself in this scenario where she'd be on a dog walk in the park and she would suddenly find herself getting a call from this people smuggler, and she'd sit down on a bench and she'd be on the phone and people she knew would try to speak to her and she'd have to ignore them. So it was almost like these worlds were colliding for her. And the only way that she could get through it was to sort of isolate herself from the rest of the world and just do whatever she could to try and help her sister.
Guess we all have coping methods. Yes, I mean, I can't hardly even imagine. So were you able to talk to other friends and family in Indiana or elsewhere? And what image of Sam did you get before you were actually able to meet her?
I mean, one of the things that I'm most proud of in this series is pretty much anyone you can imagine we have been able to track down and speak to. So in I'm Not a Monster, we speak to childhood friends of Sam, we speak to her best mates, we speak to her exes, we speak to people who knew her within ISIS, we speak to ISIS members, we speak to people that the family owned as slaves while they were in Raqqa. We track them down in Iraq. We get a very detailed account of their life with Sam and her family. And we speak to her parents. We speak to Matthew. So we build this incredibly detailed and comprehensive picture that plays out in a way that is accessible to people. I mean, the press in England have been saying, you know, this has to end up as a TV series. It's insane. And it's because it is basically like listening to a real life true crime thriller.
I mean, it is. I mean, it does seem like out of a movie, something made up, you know. And as I understand it, you know, when you started hearing the accounts of possibly the psychology of Sam and talking to people that she knew closely about what was she like, you know, it's not rare to get conflicting views on a subject that we're reporting on. But what was it like to hear from multiple people, even very close family members, that the main subject of your story was manipulative, that maybe you couldn't trust things that she would say?
Well, you know, the difficulty was, one minute I would speak to somebody who would be like, Sam is the sweetest, most loving, beautiful, caring best friend I could have ever hoped for. And the next minute I would speak to somebody who would tell me she was a snake. And then I would speak to somebody else who'd tell me she was brilliant. And then I would speak to somebody else who'd be like, you can't trust her. She's just out to manipulate. So it just added to this journalistic difficulty of trying to find the truth. And to be honest with you, I think it took 4 years to get to a point where we can categorically say we really understand what happened here.
I mean, and of course, we want everyone to listen to the podcast, but we don't want to spoil anything. But you do say in the podcast that you were taken aback by what you heard from her father when he questioned her. What was it about that moment that really stuck out to you?
I mean, so the first time I went to meet her father, Rick, was it was an experience. It was great. I mean, Rick is a good guy. I really got on with him. But I remember traveling to his house, and he lives in quite a remote part of the States. And we were having this chat, and I'd come there to speak about his daughter. And the first thing he wanted to do is he wanted me to shoot his vintage Eastern European rifle with retractable bayonet. And I guess he figured I'd been to Iraq, I must like guns. So I find myself in his back garden shooting at bottles and missing, trying to sort of win the guy over. And we ended up getting on quite well. I think he found it quite funny how poor a shot I am. I feel like I'm fulfilling an English stereotype there. And then as we started to talk more and more about Sam, you know, at this point, everyone had told me she's great. You know, she's not an extremist. She's really looked after me. She's a great mom. Rick, her father, just comes out and be like, you can't trust her. You can't trust her. And half the time you can't tell what the truth is and what not the truth is. That's what he said, quote. And so I was suddenly like, whoa, okay, hold on. You mentioned earlier that I've done lots of ISIS stories. You know, over the years, mm-hmm. I've been able to speak to relatives of lots of different people who either ended up in extremist groups or were or are in extremist groups. And it's very common for them to talk about how their sort of loved one was misled. Either they were manipulated through social media or they were misled by a friend. Mm-hmm. But Rick just came out and said, no, she lies a lot and she's extremely manipulative. So I was very taken aback by that. And that was another one of those things of, okay, well, what's the truth? Why would Rick say this? You know, and that's sort of, that's all in episode two.
As a journalist, you know, it can be very difficult to gain the trust of some people that you need to talk to. This is obviously a very sensitive subject, especially for people in her family like Rick. And I assume some of them just didn't want to talk about it. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, even to some degree, Matthew's father, Juan, it took a very long time for him to agree to speak to me. I initially contacted him when I was heading into Syria to try and find his son to just say, look, I'm not trying to get an interview from you, but I am conscious I'm looking for your son. And if I find him, I'll let you know. I'll let you know how he's doing. And from there, you know, maybe 8-9 months later, I got to sit down with him for the first time and then we met. One of the times that I went to meet Juan, it was quite an entertaining situation. So the only time he could meet was on his annual elk hunt with his brother. So I found myself having to fly out from the UK to the US, and all I had to find one were a set of coordinates. So I was wandering through this bear infested forest on my own with my phone and my GPS, trying to work out where his camp was. And it took 2 days to find him. It's probably the most extreme I've had to go to for an interview.
And this was in which state?
I'm trying to remember where that was. I think that was in Idaho. Would that make sense? You have to forgive me. My American geography is terrible. I spent so much time in your country and I love it very much. But I'm so bad. You've got to remember our entire country, England, you can drive from top to bottom in about 13 hours. We're a very small island.
Yeah, it is a little bit larger here. Idaho sounds about right, though. Such interesting information that you're gaining before you even, you know, make it to that next step. Back to the video, you know, and we talked a little bit about, you know, just that how different of a tactic this was from what we were used to seeing from ISIS. Did you get any sense for why they might have used Matthew in a video like this and a child and propaganda?
Yeah, no, definitely. So it was basically because America's boots on the ground in Syria for a long time were a militia, a Kurdish ethnic militia. And they had been historically very marginalized within Syria. And when the war broke out, they sort of grew and grew and grew and became this 50,000 strong force that America went in, trained and provided weapons with and worked with to defeat ISIS. So they were highly effective. And this Kurdish militia, with America's help, had pushed into Raqqa and were retaking the city. They were, you know, they were beating ISIS. They were fighting hard. It was a brutal fight, but they were winning. So at this time, the world knew that ISIS was on the way out and ISIS was pretty much over. So in an act of desperation, the terror group decided, we will use an American boy to try and show the world that we still have power and we have strengths and we're still capable. So in a, it was basically they decided to, you know, put Matthew in this horrific position because they were desperate, because they were losing and they wanted to try and deflect attention away from that.
Yeah. Seems like, you know, for so many years, you know, we were so focused on everything that was happening in Syria, and especially here at National Public Radio at NPR, you know, we covered a lot about the ISIS situation in Syria and the war there for so many years. And it was strange to see it sort of fade away. And I mean, I hope to be able to chat with you as we are back on the other side of the break about, you know, where ISIS is today. We are talking today with Josh Baker, journalist, about his new podcast from the BBC and Frontline PBS called I'm Not a Monster, which tells the story of an Indiana woman and her family moving to ISIS-controlled Syria in 2015. I'm Jill Sheridan. We will be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back now to our conversation on a new podcast from the BBC and Frontline PBS called I'm Not a Monster, which tells the story of an Indiana woman and her family moving to ISIS-controlled Syria in 2015. We're talking to Josh Baker, writer of the I'm Not a Monster podcast, who is joining us live from London. Welcome back again. Thanks, Josh.
Thanks.
So there's a scene in the podcast where you're talking to Sam's sister, Lori, and you tell her, you know, about this video that we were just talking about with Matthew, and we can hear her watching the video, again, just one of the great things about podcasts, and reacting to it, you know, while she's on the phone there with you. What was that like for you, working as a journalist on such a long-term project like this and such an extremely personal story? It's hard to navigate these kinds of moments sometimes.
Yeah, no, definitely. And you're watching a lady who's talking about her sister and her niece and nephews that are trapped in a war zone, and there's a desperate plea for help in front of her, and she doesn't know what to do. And I suppose the difficulty is as a journalist, when you're faced with situations where you're with people who are very upset or who've just gone through a trauma or going through a trauma. That as a human being, you naturally want to empathize and take care of this person. But as a journalist, you have to be one step removed. And that's not to say you have to be unkind, but you're there to do a job. And you're there to try and understand the facts of a situation and what's going on. So you sort of personally have to keep a lot of that emotion locked up inside you to make sure that you can do your job properly. And you also don't detract from what the person in front of you is feeling.
So back to when you ended up, you know, tracking down Sam and her children and going to Syria for the first time, you said, to Syria.
Yeah.
You know, did some of your previous contacts help? I mean, how does something like this happen? How did you end up tracking her down? I can't, you know, even imagine.
Basically, I had started to lay the groundwork of getting in contact with people in Syria and establishing a sort of broad brush of different people, contacts for different people. And this was anything from Westerners working on the ground, NGO workers, militia members, local journalists, and just trying to have this contact book there. So when I saw this video of Sam and her family escaping ISIS, I immediately went out to these people and just said, look, how can I, you know, have you heard anything? Where would this person be? Where do I need to look? And it took about 48 hours, but someone came back to me. And essentially what they said is that we know where Sam is or was recently. And they told me the town in Syria where she was. And they told me that she was being held in a military base inside the town. And that was enough for me to get the BBC and Frontline to green light me going to look for her.
So in a situation like that, the BBC and Frontline helped to facilitate.
Yeah, so the BBC obviously funded the project. So I went out with a teammate, a friend of mine who's a medic, and he and I, you know, after some very sleepless days, got to Syria, And we eventually made our way to this base, and we got there and we found out she wasn't there anymore. So we're like, okay. And now we start the search for her. So she wasn't there, and we spent a few more days searching, and then we found another base and went inside. And then I found a commander, and he had pictures of the family on his phone. So it was like, oh, wow. Okay. This we're getting closer. Mm-hmm. And he told me he'd just sent them to another base a few hours from where we'd just come. So we're like, oh, for crying out loud. So we went back to our hotel. And then that night we got a tip off as to where they were. And the next morning I found myself on another military base with a very senior person in Syria, who basically said to me, you can see Sam, but if you lie about why you're here or anything you're doing, I'm going to put you in prison. And I was like, oh God, well, this is an ominous thing. I just want to get an interview. So he gave me a piece of paper and he said, write down who you are, why you're here, and why you want to speak to Sam. So I did that. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. He takes the piece of paper, hands it to somebody. That person leaves the room. About 10 minutes goes by. Then before I know it, the door opens. In runs Matthew. Mm-hmm. In runs another kid. And then there's Sam with the other children. It was just the most bizarre moment. And I obviously, by this point, I've been looking for Sam for almost a year. Mm. And my sort of jaw dropped, and I didn't really know what to say. I mean, it was the first time in my career I've genuinely been stunned into silence.
Wow. What must it have been like then to finally meet Sam face to face, somebody that you had been looking for and covering for so long?
Well, I mean, I was just trying to formulate the words. I mean, my mind had sort of, the computer had shut down momentarily because it didn't know how to process what was actually happening. And then it became about, you know, how is Matthew? Is Matthew okay? How are the kids? And try to understand that and spending a bit of time with them. And I just very slowly started to talk to Sam. Now, initially, when I first met her, we talked for about 45 minutes. And during the process of that conversation, I asked her about who was this supposed people smuggler who your sister was talking to. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, someone in that room misheard what I was saying and started to assume I was trying to smuggle Sam out of Syria. And before I knew it, I was being taken out of the room and accused of being a British spy.
Oh my God.
And I ended up having to leave Syria. And then it wouldn't be until 3 months later or so that I would come back with a camera and finally film an interview with Sam. And when I came back, I was confronted by a very different Sam. The woman I'd met before was somebody, you know, who was still in traditional Islamic dress. Mm-hmm. Her English was a little broken, almost like it was her second language, which was a bit strange. Mm-hmm. And then when Sam came through the door the second time, she was in a baseball cap, a puffer jacket, jeans. She had earrings, jewelry. It was a very different Sam, you know. And from there, we started to get her account of the last few years of her life under ISIS. And that's what I then took to start to piece together whether she was telling the truth or not.
So, I mean, obviously, Sam's story is very entwined with her husband, with this man that allegedly brought her to Syria. Who was this man?
So Musa was a Moroccan man who came to the US to study. He outstayed his visa and he ended up in Indiana, where he met Sam. And they seemed to have a relatively comfortable life in America for a time. You know, they had a decent business. They drove nice cars. They seemed to have access to a lot of cash. So it wasn't like they were leaving, when they left America, a bad life. They had money. And he, it appears, during this time, started to become a little bit bored with his life. And somewhere along the way, ended up being, it appears, We can't be certain, but it appears he ended up being radicalized by his brother, who was also in the US studying. And they set in motion a plan to take the family to Syria. Now, as the podcast will go through, if you listen to it, I'm Not a Monster, we unpick whether Sam was part of that plan or not. We know she wasn't a supporter of ISIS ideologically, but we unpick whether she was a part of the plan to go to ISIS with her husband or not. And sort of that's one side of him. Now, the other side of him is I made a couple of trips to Raqqa in Syria, and I met lots of people who knew the family. I met, as I mentioned earlier, former slaves the family had owned. I met neighbours of theirs. I went to houses they'd lived in. And I was able to piece together a picture of somebody who was somehow went from being seemingly a normal American guy to a fully fledged ISIS fanatic who fully embraced the beliefs of ISIS and would become an ISIS sniper. We believe, we're not certain, but we believe he went on to become an ISIS commander, and he would later be killed, we believe, in a drone strike in Raqqa, defending the city against the Kurdish militia, the American-backed Kurdish militia.
Like you said, I mean, just such great fodder for a podcast, because you really want to hear from these people and hear, you know, how somebody may end up in a situation like this. It's really incredible.
Totally. And when in Raqqa, we were also there and we were trying to piece together things that Sam had told us about her life there. So one of the big things that she told us was that she'd tried to escape or had set in motion a plan to escape. And she had ended up in a supposed ISIS torture prison. And she gave this big account of how she was held there for 2 months and what happened to her. So when we went back to Raqqa, it was not long after the fighting had ended. And then when I went back again, we found this this prison, and we got inside it. It's now sort of sealed shut at either end, like a sort of tomb. Basically, what ISIS had done is they converted the city's soccer stadium into a prison, and the basement and the changing rooms and the gym of this stadium have been converted into cells. And when the Kurdish militia took the city back, they bricked it up at either end. So it was sort of frozen in time, if you can imagine. Mm. And we went inside and started looking for evidence that Sam was there and piecing together little things about whether her story was true. And we also went around the city finding the locations where Matthew had been forced to appear in the ISIS propaganda video.
And you were able to find those locations. Incredible.
Yeah, it took some doing.
Yeah, I'd say. You know, we know Sam came back to the States in 2018. And again, we don't want to reveal all the podcasts, but, you know, can you tell us what's happened to Sam since she has come back to the United States?
Yeah, so Sam was, for reasons that we don't really know to this day, Sam was essentially, after Sam escaped ISIS, she was held in a sort of detention camp in Syria with many other Westerners from actually, you know, people across the world who did travel to join ISIS. Mm. Now, in July 2018, the American Special Forces took Sam out of Syria. They left another American family. They went in and they took Sam and her kids, and they flew her back to Indiana. And when she landed in Indiana, she was arrested and taken to jail, and her children were taken into the protection of Child Protective Services. Sam then was initially charged with lying to an FBI officer, which seemed like a very strange charge for someone who'd been for years with ISIS. We'd later find out that's because before she left America, she was actually working as an FBI informant. Huh. And the FBI were using this as a holding charge. It's not uncommon, I'm told, for them to charge somebody with a lesser charge, keep them in jail, keep them detained, and then build a stronger case against them. And that's exactly what they did with Sam. And she would end up being charged with providing two counts of material support for terrorism. And the FBI alleged that Sam had been part of her husband and brother-in-law's planned to join ISIS and that she had carried cash and gold to the Islamic State for them.
I understand that she also had a plea agreement. Can you explain what the plea agreement that Sam agreed to was?
Yeah, so for the entire time I'd known Sam, she was adamant that she was innocent and she'd been put in this position against her will, that she didn't want to join ISIS. It was because of her husband. She was in an abusive relationship and that she would never take a deal. But then in November 2019, she did. And she decided that she would say it was better for her to take a deal than risk a trial that would do further damage to her family. That's her account. You could also argue that the evidence against her was pretty damning. And what this agreement did is it allowed a limitation of her sentence, and it allowed her to know that she would be getting out of jail at some point and potentially have a fresh start at seeing her kids again. And it's interesting because when she went through the hearing, at the end of it, the judge decided that Sam would not have been in the room if it was not for the actions of her husband. So it then becomes a question of, so why did Sam do this? Why did she go along with it?
Mm-hmm. That is the question. And I know you've done, you know, a lot of reporting on other people. You mentioned they might be, you know, detained in Syria at the time. People around the world, though, who flew to Syria to join ISIS. You know, just generally, what kinds of people typically do this? Or is it hard to see a pattern?
No, it's not. It's not necessarily hard to see a pattern. I mean, Sam does not fit a pattern, I have to say. Her case is unique. But, you know, typically what we see is that ISIS were very good at using social media to tap into communities where there were people who were perhaps struggling or vulnerable to these ideas. So I'll give you an example. One of the things that was described to me is that there's a community in London where we have sort of second generation immigrants who have come from conservative countries who essentially have very traditional values. So they come here, they have kids, and then their kids find themselves in this difficult situation where they're trying to live under the ideals of their parents, but simultaneously trying to fit in with, you know, liberal Western society that is London. So there's a sort of conflict of identity there. And what ISIS seemed to be very good at doing in this community was tapping into that conflict and tapping into that sense of like, no, look, here's your identity. You should be part of this. Come to us. And they ran a very effective, I would say, grooming campaign and were able to recruit fighters, tens of thousands of fighters and women and families from across the world. I mean, you know, we're talking more than north of 40,000, 50,000 people from potentially as many as 100 countries, if not more.
Pretty incredible stories. I'm sure many stories to be told. And everyone should really listen to your podcast to listen to this particular story, because there's a lot to unpack. Josh Baker, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Josh is the writer of I'm Not a Monster podcast, which you can find online at pbs.org/frontline or at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also watch a documentary of the story called Return from ISIS on Frontline's website. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. This is All In.